Okay, so what we're trying to do in this class is to analyze narratives in their own terms, which is always fun, and but also to see how those narratives for our own for ourselves and in contemporary literature are used as the basis for deciding medical ethics questions. So a brief introduction to how medical ethics is done in the contemporary halakhic community is probably worthwhile. And this, I think, is a general issue. I usually cite this from my teacher, Rabbi J. David Bleich, as there are two basic approaches to approaching new questions in halakha. One is to say that we take the closest available precedent and we stretch it. And the other is to say sometimes we realize we're in a totally new situation and we have to start from scratch. And he attributes the first position to Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz, the Chazon Ish, who's a late 20th century figure, and the second position, that there are such things as new questions, to Rabbi Shabtai Cohen, or the Shach, who is, I believe, a 17th century commentator of the Shulchan Aruch. But those are flags of convenience for those basic approaches. Now, the issue that I tend to think that when you have radical change as opposed to incremental change, then you're going to have to take the approach that there are new questions. Otherwise, you end up saying things that are ridiculous. And as it happens, the examples I usually use for ridiculousness are medical ethics questions. And the best example, I think, of this is dealing with the question of how you deal with surrogate motherhood. Who's the mother? The biological mother, the gestational mother, or the parturative mother? Because now you can actually have three different, right? Because you can have take an egg, you can implant it in one woman's womb, take it out, and implant it in another woman's womb. So you could actually have three different women biologically related to it. Leaving aside the issue of chimeras, which is right where you can mix the genes, and actually have two women's genes involved in the birth. So the best evidence we have for that is a midrash, which talks about how Dina, Leah's daughter, was originally supposed to be Rachel's child. Amin, Rachel's second son, was supposed to be Dinah's child. But Dinah realized that would end up with Rachel being in a socially inferior position because she would have fewer tribes generated than the two maidservants, Bilhah and Zilpah. So she prayed, and the fetuses were switched. And nonetheless, Dinah is Leah's daughter, and Binyamin is Rachel's daughter. So we see that it's parturative mother, and not biological mother. Now that's true, right? That does follow from the narrative, but it's a very weak read to build a legal theory on. So I think that I was generally of the position that one should acknowledge that that in new cases one should go back to first principles.
Why is that?
Because it was never intended legally. You know, someone's telling a story. It's a fun story.
All the time, doesn't it?
It generates a background cultural assumption, but it's not law, it's not legal precedent, it's narrative precedent. Uh-huh. And one particular wild narrative precedent that isn't, you know, like one of these central stories in the tradition that, you know, that everyone has time to think about whether, well, do we really buy this story legally or not. But I was, as I was teaching my medical ethics class at New Jewish High School this year, I realized that, so that theory that you start from scratch works pretty well when you think there are first principles that can usefully derive law. Right, I think I understand what the basic principles I think the tradition says are, and I'm going to try and apply those principles fairly directly as opposed to extending what I think are inadequate precedents. What happens if you have a situation that is so new that you don't even have the principles? And that's where I've hit in my classes this semester, where, you know, we've talked about all sorts of issues like genetic screening and things like that, where I think there's just nothing. I don't have the beginning of an approach. It seems to me in those cases where one acknowledges that in large measure one is being almost entirely constructive, then you have to try and figure out, so what's a reasonable methodology? Because what I think I'm not willing to accept is the notion that 150 years from now we'll be in the exact same boat. And we'll say that, you know, Judaism, Torah have absolutely nothing to contribute to this discussion because it first came up 100 years ago and we just had nothing to say. So there has to be some way, even in questions about which there is no, right, there isn't even a first principled approach, Right, there has to be some way of constructing a tradition. Right, there is such a, like, if you move them to such a high level of generality, you know, you can have very, like, you know, be nice to people, right? If you're reduced to be nice to people as your first principle, so there's nothing uniquely Jewish about be nice to people. I would think if you want to say something, you know, valuable from a Jewish standpoint, then yeah, you want to say something that, you know, if you just say be nice to people so you don't have to come out of Judaism, you can come out of any, you know, the big philosophies.
So
what I'm trying to do is to, I'm planning on spending the summer doing a more detailed halachic analysis, going through responsa literature as for a seminar. What I'm trying to do here is, the fact is that most of the responsa literature is built off these narratives. Going on, is it, whether acknowledged or not, is the process of trying to do precisely that, to take the, what we might call the deep moral structure of the narratives and turn them into law. But I think that to read the narratives as law, right, is right, not reading the narratives properly. Narratives are narratives. And I think we need to be more conscious of the fact that what we're doing is transforming, right, is transforming a narrative into law, as opposed to deducing the law from the narrative as a story first, and then try and figure out what is the story really about, and to what degree, as opposed to telling me this story functions as a legal precedent, tell me if this story tells me something, right, allows me to derive first principles. Because I think there are a lot of Talmudic stories which don't really fit so well with halakha. And that's okay, because, you know, they're not trying to dot every I and cross every T. There is a mode of reading biblical stories, for example. I like to cite the Rugged Shever, who believed everything was halachic. So after Akedat Yitzchak, so Avram goes and says, he sees a ram over there caught by its horns in the bush. But he kachet ayel. I'm skipping some words, but he took the ayel. So why do we have to say he took the ram? Because there's a machloket, and there's a dispute in the Gemara as to whether you're allowed to bring sacrifices from animals that are unowned, or whether you can only bring sacrifices from your own property. So Abraham, trying not to get involved in that dispute, right, made sure that he acquired the ram first before he brought it as a sacrifice in place of Isaac. That's what we call a hyper legal reading, which isn't what the story is about at all. Right? The story has no interest in the question of whether sacrifices have to be brought from something which is technically your property or not. Clearly, the story believes that if we were to do a first principle assumption, why would it have to be yours? You know, you have to have some history with it. You have to have earned it. Anything like that. Right, the story is not about that at all. Right, the story is about serendipitously, right, God giving him a ram to replace, right, to replace Isaac. So I think that would be a case where deducing, and if I were to argue that we can derive from that story that one has to acquire a ram before a sacrifice, that would not be a good reading.
Very frequent that he'll take something of the ram and give an interpretation, a lock interpretation that really doesn't fit.
Again, what the rabbis rarely derive law from narrative in Torah.
Right. Okay. Right. But I mean, there are many times psukim we're talking about all kinds of things.
I tend to think that the system of midrash halacha is actually very rigorous, mm-hmm. And that when it's a productive thing, right? Jay Harris has the whole book about whether midrash halacha is productive or post facto. And I think that the most possible reading is that it's sometimes one and sometimes the other, and that that productive midrash halacha actually follows fairly rigorous rules. It may not be the rules that we would see as normal reading, but statutory construction in any system, the way in which you read statutes is different than the way you read ordinary language, and it functions. So that doesn't bother me as much.
Okay, but we don't have the equivalent thing for stories.
Well, you have occasionally, you know, in the article I published on torture. Right, so I talked about how the Binyan Sion, for example, which is a 19th century figure, derives the notion that you can't humiliate a pursuer from the fact that Tamar sends Yehuda's symbols to him instead of publicly declaring them, because she would not have been justified in humiliating him by announcing it. He had to do it himself, because it was his choice. That's an example. You know, that's an example where the same process takes place. But I think it's less often.
I got a
Okay. So with that as background, and you know, that's a very broad methodological background. We'll see if it makes a difference at all. But that's just what I'm hoping will come out of this is the capacity to read the stories as stories. And I think the stories we're reading are not only tangentially telling us details about the relationship between quality and quantity of life, but they're actually thematic. They're actually thematic meditations on that question, at least in some places, or at least, or maybe that we need to make methodological distinctions between stories in which it so happens that somebody has to face that choice, and stories which are fundamentally about that choice. Tonight's story, I think, is directly on that question.
So are you saying to me first principles from the halakha?
I think that's one of the things one has to do, right? Is one has to go back to narratives. And
I don't know if there's going to be anything you can tell.
I think the narratives play a different function when there is law. I think narratives play different. When there is law, the narratives are there to try and shape the development of the law. Right, narrative or provide a critique of the law, which is different than when all you have is narrative.
Can we back up a little bit and discuss?
Yeah, there isn't an objective line. You know, sometimes you just feel the precedent you look at it and you say it's gotten to the point of absurdity. And everyone has their own line. You know, in every area of halakha, you have technological change that creates radical break. electricity could have created a radical break. We're still struggling with it. Corporations could have created a radical break. We're still struggling with it in economics. And I think that in this particular question, the end of life issues, the crisis that comes on is the recognition that just about, I mean, I was reading Baruch Brody's book, and I was talking to my brother-in-law working in a hospital. The reading they have is that most patients die now before the last possible moment that they could die. If you walk into a hospital, right, most deaths are short-term preventable.
Measures.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's a totally different universe. In a universe in which it's not like you really have that much, right? That much option. It's a rare case. Now we're just dealing with everyday social decisions, some of which seem very reasonable, and it's frightening that the halakha would say something different, and some of which seem quite horrifying. And it's frightening that they happen. My brother-in-law, gave me a real life case 3 weeks ago with what happened in the hospital, and I took it into my class, and both of them, this was a perfectly normal hospital decision, and pretty much we were all the impression that somebody should be prosecuted for manslaughter.
Mm. Pretty,
a case of somebody who had a heart attack, was therefore had to have in a condition where they were sedated, and therefore they couldn't make their own medical decisions. A bypass operation was possible, but the next of kin was told that the effect of the bypass operation would likely be survival with much less active physically. Not debilitated, just much less active physically. And the relative decided that the patient would rather not live than live incapable of leading the active athletic life they'd lived previously. And so they withdrew care. 50.
Oh, 50
as
opposed to 94.
That was just, just say, wow.
Well, no, would you feel differently if the patient had said, I'd rather die than not?
I would feel differently, but how differently, I don't know. I'm still working out my approach, but that just struck me. That this was not seen as weird.
I don't see it as weird if we accept that the patient, supposedly this is supposed to be.
I understand how legally it gets to that result.
No, it's not so legal. I think even morally, if you accept
it. I don't know. I mean, we'd have to talk about this, what boundary. What we call sanity, what we call insanity, why we still criminalize, so we don't consider that. Those issues are all in play. That was just, to me, that was just a case that brought home how far at sea we were as halachas, because we didn't know, I don't think there was a category in halacha to deal with that.
Oh, so there's no
sock? Most, if you read the public literature, the formal code literature all says life, life, life. The responsible literature is all case by case allowing it. Mm-hmm. When I read it, it feels like what the Chavot Yair Greta Karas, gut instinct. There isn't a foundation that makes me confident, okay, I'm making a decision out of this. Emerges, I think, really, is it emerges out of people's readings of narratives. Right, so that's why I'm trying to go back to the narratives, because if you read the responsible literature, they float around a set, on this issue, they float around a set of narratives. But but they don't treat the narratives as narratives, right? So that's what I'm trying to do. See, what happens if we look at those narratives as narratives, as opposed to as incidental law, right? Incidental evidence of law. Now you can do that. You know, my teacher, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, teaches a course called, you know, responsa as a source of history, right? Where the job is to mine the responsa to tell you something about the real world that people lived in. You know, imagine that 100 years from now, somebody could read a responsa to try and find out something about technology of refrigerators in the late 20s. All sorts of interesting things about how compressors work, right? You know, but it's not what it's about, right? And there might very well be places where he is assimilating the scientific category to halachic category, which isn't quite precise because it works for his legal purposes, and you'll end up with a totally distorted technological vision. Not interested in the technology as such, he's interested in how the technology fits into his legal categories. And so he needs to call things certain things. Okay, so let's take a look at the narrative. Narrative is really fun.
Just
one more question. All right, I started
it. With a comment.
Yeah.
When you spoke about gut instinct.
Yeah.
You know, another approach to ethics is that you have lived by halacha all their lives,
uh-huh.
And their gut instinct has been conditioned.
Right.
It's not just anybody's gut instinct. It's a Jewish halachic instinct.
Right.
So that makes it a little bit different.
Yeah, so, you know, when I'm in a controversial mode within Orthodoxy, so I like to give a speech called Why Modern Orthodoxy Should Believe in Das Torah, which is essentially what you're saying. You know, as somebody who is, you know, who sees himself as a producer as well as a consumer, so I think that in order for my instinct to develop, I need to have some intellectual content to it. I don't think that God just implants instincts in me that I'm comfortable telling. Right, saying that's what should happen. It might be possible for someone else to say, okay, that's how, you know, that's why I trust you. But for me to feel the right that I have the right to answer people's questions in a binding fashion, because that's what I feel. I don't know why I feel that way. I just learned lots of Torah. It doesn't work very well for me.
Okay.
I will this summer, and maybe
presumably, if you X just didn't feel right. So do X.
Okay, that's a much deeper legal theory question about how a post-stake works. That's an entirely different course. entirely different course. I will be spending, I'm trying to actually get together a rabbinic conference, so which will give me an occasion of questions. It's one of the projects the center is now happily working on. I won't do the advertisement now. Okay, so the story that we have begins in the Book of Judges in Sefer Shoftim. So right in chapter 1, so we were in the middle of the original Jewish-Israelite conquest of Canaan, which, as you know, is formally a genocidal conquest, right? That's the way it's depicted as ideally, although it doesn't seem to quite succeed that way, and, you know, that's a different halachic context, whether it ought to be or ought not to be, where I have at least have argued in places I don't think it's so eccentric that ideally it would have been a culturally totalitarian conquest, but it doesn't mean that the ideal was to actually kill people. The ideal was to culturally supplant. Maimonides seems pretty clearly to read it that way. Okay, but what's going on is you have this list of where the tribes go, and Beit Yosef, which are the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, go up to Beit El, and God was with them, and then we find out, well, God is with them, doesn't actually win the battle by itself. So they come out to the town of Beit El. And here we are told the name of the city earlier, right, was Luz. Now that, if one is a sensitive rabbinic reader, is already a caution note. Because the city, which is Beit El and Luz, shows up in one other prominent place earlier in Luz, which is where Yaakov has his dream. And there too, right, it tells us Beit El, which was Luz, which seems to be... Right, which seems, again, if one is a rabbinic reader, this certainly tells us there must be something significant about the name. Now, there is an ongoing debate in rabbinic literature, which is not so relevant to us tonight, about whether Beit El and Luz are in fact in the same place, whether Beit El is actually Yerushalayim, and Yaakov has some kind of trans-dimensional experience in which he is... He begins at Luz, but God brings Yerushalayim to Beit El, right, to Luz. So, right, because there are other places where Beit El, you know, and to say that this is Shar HaShemayim, this is the gateway to heaven, right, so in later rabbinic tradition, that has to be Jerusalem, right, that's what Jacob says, you have to find some way to bring Jerusalem to lose. But there seems to be some significance to the name. And then we have this interesting episode where the Shomrim, which seems to be ironically, it's not usually the Shomer at the gate is the guard watching lest people come in, but here the Shomer appears to be the guard, the siege guard, the guard watching to make sure that no one gets out, and somebody slips out of the city. Now the question you have to ask, of course, is how did this person get out of the city? Why aren't there guards inside the gate the same way there are guards outside the gate, such that the only person escaping the city, the person escaping the city is noted only by the people outside it? But they see one man coming outside the city. They somehow don't see how he gets out of the city. And they tell him, Harinu not mivo ha'ir, show us the way into the city, ve'asinu imcha chesed, and then we will do chesed with you. And his motivation is not given, but he shows them the entrance to the city.
Well, to get the chesed, so he's not going to...
It could be that it's not the promise that when we conquer the city we'll do chesed with you, it's just right now. Mm-hmm. Right? They've captured him, and so he gives in. Rabbinic literature isn't so into reading it that way. Doesn't seem. So he shows them the way to the city, and they put the whole city to the sword, but they send that man and his entire family away. Vayelech ha'ish eretz ha'chitim, so the man goes to the land of Hittites, vayiven ir, he builds a city, vayikrash ha'maluz. And he calls the city Luz, Hushima Arayomazeh, and the city Luz still has that name today. Now, for readers of prophetic texts, the statement Luz is still his name today is always problematic, because when is today? Right? Is today at the time of writing, or is today at the time of reading? It's a prophetic text, it should be his name. Right? So we get the notion. First, it's not only that the city Luz is still there today; its name is still Luz today, right? So there's a very strong emphasis given to the idea, once again, that there's something about this city's name which is significant. Okay, that's all we know at this story. Right? We don't know anything about it. Right? It's a suggestive.
Is there a city now known as Luz?
Is there again a city named Luz?
Yeah.
I don't know if there is a city again. It would surprise me if there were. I mean, there is a city called Beit El. Maybe they call it Beit El / Luz.
Well, that's going to be a different city from the new
city. Yeah, well, you know where Luz is...
But it isn't Bedell.
Do we need more cups?
Okay. So now what happens... What do the rabbis do with this? So so we have a Braita, which is a text from the period of the Mishnah that didn't quite make it into the Mishnah, which says that Rabbi Meir liked saying it. This is just my excuse to use the word want in a sentence. The mayor would often say that, right, kofim al-lalvaya, which means we compel people to perform the mitzvah of walking out with guests, and escorting people on the way. Why? Because it's for their own good, because the reward of escorting is infinite. Now, what's the reward of escorting? We get this city. Okay, so the narrative, we get the narrative of this city, and really all Rabbi Meir said was that that he tells the story and he says, you know what, the reason the man gets to build this city is that he shows them the way. And even though, you know, so they seem to think at least it's willing that he shows them the way, right? That's why I don't like the story that he does it under threat. That doesn't seem to be the reading. Because of that, right, if we skip the indented part, so we say if this Canaanite who spoke, neither spoke with his mouth nor went with his feet, caused rescue for himself and his descendants until the end of all generations. So somebody who does levayav, actually walking with somebody, right, if he actually, you know, should get that much more reward. Okay, so we've constructed... somehow the claim that there's this infinite reward because the person showed them the extent of the city, and then we have fun trying to figure out exactly what he did if he didn't walk with them, you know, so we just sort of like moved his mouth a little bit or something like that. No, that doesn't matter to us. What matters is where do we get this idea that the Canaanite caused rescue for himself and his descendants until the end of all generations? How do we know that they're still around? Right, maybe it just lasted that one generation and they're wiped out the next time. So in terms of the text, it seems pretty clear the answer is the phrase Ara Yom Hazeh. But how do we know that it's still this man and his descendants? So here, right, there's an interjection, there's an interjecting breita, right, which is what I have indented, which is a breita that glosses this text, which says that the city luz that the man built is the same luz in which the tchelet industry took place, which read the blue dye that was used in tzitzit and was also senators, I believe. Right, the emperor wore purple and senators wore blue, I think. It's the same, right? Now this luz survived both biblical destructions, right? The Tanakh records the destructions of the two kingdoms, the two original Jewish kingdoms in Israel separately. The kingdom of Israel is destroyed by Sancheriv, and the kingdom of Judah is described by Nebuchadnezzar. So this city luz survives both destructions. And then finally it says, and even the angel of death does not have the authority to enter the city of luz. So the city is taken as a city out of time. When we say Ara Yom Hazeh, it doesn't just mean that the city has survived, it's that the city has sort of survived in a bubble all these years, because the angel of death can't walk in. Okay, so then, so now that you've constructed this immortal city, so now you actually have room to meditate on the question, what's an immortal city like? And here it says, rather, the elders within is the Kenim Shabo. And now we get into lots of textual variants, which you have to try and figure out how significant they are. The text that we have in the standard printed Vilna edition says, rather, Bizman Shedat, the Kenim Shabo, the elders within it, Bizman Shedatan Katze Alehen, which I'm translating as when their minds become oppressive to them. Not quite clear what Kai means.
Are they in short memory, something like that?
I don't think so. I think like the reference are like katzti b'chayay b'nei b'nei b'chayt, right, where Rivka finds it disgusting, v'yakutsu m'pnei b'nei Yisrael, the Egyptians, right, so it's oppressive with this sort of tinge of creeping horror, right, I don't know that there's a single English word that does an adequate job of conveying it, but it, some sense where life is no longer something that is any source of joy at all.
Or thinking.
Yeah,
Datan doesn't mean their intellect.
No.
Datan means their consciousness. Okay. That'd be my take. Okay, so right, and here again, I think that we're not talking about legal byproducts, right? The point of this narrative is to reflect on what would it be like if people lived forever. Mm-hmm. Or at least what it would be like if these people lived forever, because we can say there's something about this history that has a particular impact. And the result is, it says that rather than people, right, rather than the angel of death entering it, people go out to meet death. Yes, but then which text, right? The elders go out of the city to meet death, whereas there are variants, most of the manuscripts, both of the Talmud and of other Midrashim, have that they are taken out of the city to meet death. So that's our opening narrative. Right, which seems clearly to say that immortality is not an unmixed blessing. It doesn't even say some elders within it, or should an elder happen to become oppressed with his life. It says
it's in the nature of things.
The angel of death does not go in there, but nonetheless, everybody dies. Now they die when they become very old, which some texts have, or it might just be a subjective phenomenon. That's all we have. So I'm going to go back to that thematic thing. I want to put this in.
But can you different writing by someone else?
I don't know the time, but the way I understand this literarily is Rami Meir's Breite is just right down the left hand margin, mm-hmm. and then the editor of the Talmud interjected so that you would understand what he means later when he says that he created salvation for all through his generations. Interjected this other text about Luz, right, which said that Luz is a city in which the angel of death can't come in.
I see. So one is we should read everything on this page as well. The insertions are part of it, but they're part of the same narrative.
Well, again, I would say they're not part of the same text. What I'm going to argue in a moment is, but that you'll see that the city of Luz is not it's not the product of one person's imagination, right? right? This city, Luz, the city of immortals, exists as part of the, the environment of, right? It's part of the thought environment of the Vedic world, right? This is what one might call a magical realism. I think that's the genre we would call it, like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, right? It's a universe in which it's not seen as a breach in the order of events for there to be a city that the angel of death can't come into. Right? There are places that angels can't go, right? Perhaps fools rush in there, I don't know. And so I suggest, so now I might, if I were having fun being a critic, I might think that, well, you know, the original text said, you know, caused rescue for himself and all his descendants, that must mean a city in which everybody actually lives forever. And then somebody else put in this comment about, oh no, they die by themselves, and we actually have competing voices in the tradition. And that's where you start having trouble reading narrative, right? Particularly using critical readings as the basis for law, because now I just had fun constructing a dispute in rabbinic literature. Now, which one is dominant? The one which says that they live forever, or the one which says that they walk outside? I would rather, and I think as a, I think in this mode, I would not engage in that kind of critical reading, and I would read it as if it read it, I would assume, absent really compelling evidence, that there is a unified perspective. And that there is no dispute on this question of whether there were, right, of whether there were, right, whether there were elders who stayed, right, who stayed inside the city or not. So we have that story. Now, to try and locate this story in rabbinic narratives, I want to do another fun narrative, which is source number 3, which is the Gemara and Sukkah. This Gemara takes place in a context which doesn't even matter to us. It just happens that there's a fun moment in which Rabbi Yochanan comes up with this folky statement, right, that the legs of a person are his guarantors, meaning they're like the co-signers on a loan. And therefore, whenever your loan is called, meaning the loan of your life, right, therefore, right, your feet will make sure that you go there. Right, your legs co-sign the loan, and say that we promise that, you know, that when you need his soul back, then we'll take his body to the right place. Now there are these two people who are called Kushim, but Rashi in context, and I think that's correct, translates Kushim as handsome men, not as Ethiopians, right, which is an ambiguity all through Tanakh as well. And they used to stand before King Shlomo. We quote a verse describing them. And one day, it seems to be Solomon sees the angel of death looking sad. And he says, why is he looking sad? And the angel of death answers, I'm sad because I have to kill those two people. And it seems that the way Shlomo understands this right now is that the angel of death is sad because he has to take these two handsome people, and he himself, right, he himself feels sad that such people should have to die. So Shlomo immediately thinks to himself, let me make the angel of death happy. I'm going to get these people out of here. So he calls his demons, right? Because in rabbinic literature, Shlomo is the king of the demons, as well as the king of the people. So he has these Seirim, satyrs, whatever you want to call them, and he sends these two men riding on the Seirim to the vicinity of Luz. And as soon as they get to the outskirts of Luz, the vicinity of Luz, they die. Now, Rashi points out, I think he's right, that this story only makes sense against the background of our previous story. Right, why is Shlomo sending them to Luz? Right, why specifically Luz? Because Luz is where the angel of death can't get them. But it turns out, for the next day, Shlomo sees the angel of death laughing. And he says to him, why are you laughing? And he says, well, the reason I was sad yesterday is I thought I'd have to go all the way to Luz. Right, to kill these people. I thought I wouldn't get to kill these people on time because they're here and I need to kill them in Luz. And there's no way they could get to Luz in time, but you sent them on the demons. The demons can go really fast. So they made it to Luz in time and I met them, right? And I met them there. I think that Ingmar Bergman uses this in The Seven Seals. Right, in The Seventh Seal also, the notion that you run away from death only to meet death where you
are. Yeah, I was thinking
right,
that
you are.
The angel of death,
yeah.
So he sent them to Luz
to save them.
Oh, okay.
But he's helping the angel of death, because the angel of death, he thinks the angel of death doesn't want to kill them.
Right, so he sent them to Luz where they would be immortal.
Right, because the angel of death is actually waiting for them in Luz.
Okay.
And the reason he was sad was because he knew he had an appointment with them in Luz.
Okay.
And right, he was wondering how they were going to get there, because they're human beings and Luz is awfully far away. And it turns out they get there because of Shlomo's superhuman control over the demons that sends them there on time.
Because Shlomo didn't know the full story of why.
Yes. Right, Shlomo misunderstood the angel of death, and you can't actually get to the city of immortality because death is waiting in the shadow. Right, death is, and you assume the angel of death is around there a lot, waiting for the elderly people to walk out. So the city of immortals is sort of surrounded. I mean, you can imagine if you're writing the modern novel, the city of immortals is surrounded by graveyards. Right, because they're all right, because lots and lots of people, right, for an infinite amount of time, people have been walking out of that city and dying, and nobody leaves for any other reason. Because you're not ready to die. Why would you ever leave the city of immortals? Right, so everybody who ever lived in that city dies outside it, and eventually, now Borges actually has a short story I mentioned called The Immortal, which I suspect is almost certainly built off this. He generally seems to have read at least Bialik's Sefer Haggadah cover to cover, and so many of his short stories are built off Midrashim. Howard Schwartz also is a contemporary Jewish re-storyteller, has a very elaborate version of this. But if I were writing the Borges story, that's what it would be like, that you try to reach the City of Immortals, but in order to get to the City of Immortals, you have to cross an infinite graveyard. Right? Of course, you can't cross an infinity. Right? So you keep going halfway, and you never quite make it. Okay.
It's possible.
Okay. So we have... So what I'm suggesting is that we have grounds for thinking of this story as one of the as a formative story. Right? It's not one person at one point making up something, but this is a story which resonates in rabbinic literature. And I'm going to suggest that I would much rather read it as resonating in a unified way, as opposed to doing the next atomization, which creates multiple voices. So now, what can we do with this story to try and, what does this story legitimately tell us in terms of constructing a rabbinic vision of the relationship between quality and quantity of life? What would all you have is this narrative, what would you say? Okay, that's only the second story. I'm only quoting the second story so that we know that the first story is formative.
Which are you calling the second?
Source number three, yeah. Right, I'm not so much interested in that story on its own. I was really quoting that story so that you know that Luz, the City of Immortals, is an important part of Rabbinic literature.
So there's a trade-off. At some point, these people say, lift the balance and it's time to...
So it tells us, one thing it tells us is that even if they had the option, people would not live forever.
Would not want to live forever.
Yeah. Right? So it certainly tells us stage one along the lines, now we can start locating rabbinic literature along the lines that says that Tov, right, when God says this is very good, that refers to death, right, that mortality, right, that mortality is actually a gift. It's not mind. Datan Katsay doesn't mean their mind is going. It means that the state of being conscious is now oppressive. It's not intellect, right? That's
this is only one of your readings, right? The textual sources.
Yes.
They're very old and they're taking.
Right. So one version is so
they
the text.
They grow old, though. Correct?
They grow old. The other version, sorry, one version is just grow very, very old. Right. They grow very right. One text is when they get very, very old, and the other text is when somehow, for whatever reason, their consciousness becomes oppressive to them. But it's not that they get senile.
Okay, but even if it's old, what does old mean? Old means that they come.
Yeah.
Might not. This old refers to the amount of time that's passed. And they're very old because they've been on planet Earth for 350 years. Their bodies are deteriorating.
We don't know that, right? It doesn't mention anything about physical condition. I think you have lots of room. You could write the story in such a way that their bodies are perfectly intact and it's just that they get sick of. Right, they get sick of being alive, or you could write the notion that actually their bodies deteriorate and finally they just can't. Right? We don't know what their motive is.
But that's a big difference, though.
So it is.
Still, I suppose they have to get older, but if they don't really age.
I agree, and I think that this is, here we have, it's purely literary imagination as to how you write the story next. I don't think you can demonstrate from the story one way or the other. And I don't know that it would be appropriate, you know, if when we're making halakhic argumentations, you'd say, well, if there's one reading which has a 51% probability, one which has a 49% probability, so we say, oh, 51%, that must be the reading. Whereas,
but whichever reading, yeah, it's still at some point,
yes,
but
there's
voluntary or involuntary, whether it's societal or people have chosen death over life.
Okay, so you're getting to Yotzin and Motzin.
Well, right. Either way, and whether it's old age or whether it's...
Like, right, and you're reading Motzin as against their will, which is not an obvious reading either. So
but whatever reading, it's still...
Yeah, there seems to be, right? It seems like a bottom line claim is that we understand that there comes a point at which a non-insane person, right, chooses death over life.
And it doesn't sound like they're...
No, it doesn't sound like it's critiquing, although it's not also not clear that they're supporting either, right? It's
or that they're Jewish.
Or that they're Jewish. It's descriptive.
But it is a reward. We have to remember that. This is a reward.
Yes. It's a reward, it's a peculiar...
The ancestor who gave up the whole of the city
right.
So yeah. The Israelites could go and kill them all.
That's what Meyer is saying. This is his big
right.
Star.
Right.
Right. And it's, you know, so then you have to worry, as you know, in a modern key, right, we would almost certainly read this as, you know, as there's a tinge, right, of irony to it. Right. That he gets a gift that eventually he wants to give up.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we don't know whether anyone is happy before that. We just know there's a point at which they die. Right? We don't have any description of what the city is like while they're alive. Right? What is it like to live in a city in which death is always voluntary?
You think life is such a big deal, you're willing to do anything and betray your
fellows. And we're having fun, so then we play with the word chesed, and the word chesed means excess,
uh-huh.
Right? Not just kindness. Right? So that would be, you know, that's what I would say is a modernist reading, and you always have to wonder, you know, to what degree are modernist readings appropriate in rabbinic literature. You know, I have a, I usually use this illustration of the two stories of Rabbi Akiva's martyrdom and the Sadducee who is also martyred in very similar fashion, and the narratives are exactly parallel, except at the end the Sadducee dies horribly and everyone says, Pah, Sadducee, and Rabbi Akiva at his deathbed has a heavenly voice come out and say, blessed are you, Rabbi Akiva. And so, you know, the pre-modern reading is, you know, stupid Sadducee, right, blessed Rabbi Akiva, right, the modern reading is tragic Sadducee, because that could have been Rabbi Akiva, and still he dies this horrible fate, and the post-modern reading is, how do you know there wasn't a heavenly voice at his, and who was the guy who told you there was a heavenly voice at Rabbi Akiva's anyway? Because right, the post-modern reading always is the two narratives always, you can never say that one narrative has more authority than the other. So I don't know to what degree I would be, you know, I think it's really plausible if I'm trying to use the text as authority to come up with that reading, right? Although, you know, if I were doing just for literary purposes, yes, I could do that. I think we have a bottom line is that, the bottom line certainly is that we recognize that prolonging life is not an unmixed blessing. And so therefore, if you were going to justify a regime which said that life has to be held onto no matter what, it's not because it's chesed. And we actually stick that into the language, right? If we think that it's always chesed to preserve somebody's life, we understand that no. Sometimes it's not chesed to preserve somebody's life. You might have to do it anyway. But it's not chesed. And the second question is, okay, so the way in which these people react to that lack of chesed is to do something which actually causes them to die. And now we have to decide whether we see that as a normative statement or at least as an okay statement, if you do that, therefore we think it's okay to do that, or we say descriptively that's what most people will do in the same way that we say that, you know, most young men placed on Bourbon Street, at least in the old days, with lots of money and perfume are going to end up visiting houses of ill repute. Right, that would be...
It's in New Orleans.
In New Orleans.
Before you've been to this?
Before you met him.
Yeah, when I was in the House of the Rising Sun.
Perfume.
Spin the ruins of many young men, and I have gone with one. You know the song? So yeah. There's a house in New Orleans, right?
Yeah.
And that actually increases the authority to me to an extent because it tells you that this isn't just repeating a legendary story. this is a meditation, the story is written as a meditation on quality versus quantity of life. But now I should put in one thing. Why, all we've seen so far as to why the city of Luz is this way is because of Arayom Hazeh, right? Which is not enough to build this whole legend off. So why did the city of Luz become this? So we've talked about the city of Luz is really, the name has to be really important. So the Midrash has all sorts of fun with that name. Now Luz is an almond. Almond. A-L-M-O-N-D, almond, yes. Almond. So one of the versions of the story is, why can't they find the way into the city? Well, first of all, because the city's an almond, and so there's no way in, right? But it turns out that there's a cave, and at the mouth of the cave there's an almond tree, and the almond tree is hollow. And so you can go through the, right, so you can go through the Luz, into Luz, all right, and that's the way that the person shows it. That's for fun. But the other thing is, and this I assume, I don't know, but I assume this is a general ancient Near Eastern story, which the rabbis click in, which is, seems to have been some trouble trying to figure out, how is it that when God resurrects the body, it's the same body? What gives you, right, what gives a resurrected person an identity? And the response to this is, there has to be something physical about the body that's immortal also. Not just the soul itself, but something about the body also has to be indestructible, so that the body is regenerated from the, you know, sort of like the DNA, right? So you regenerate the DNA, and it turns out that the immortal part of the body is the Luz Shebeshedra.
Okay.
I don't know what it means physically, but it's the almond in the backbone. It might be. It might be.
It's
they believe
not really in the spine.
No, but you know it's.
But it might be. I don't know what it is.
But we say tchiyat ha-meitim.
But we have all the, you know, so later philosophers have lots of, Rabbi Sadia Gaon has all these discussions about what happens if you were eaten by a lion, you know, how does God reconstitute your body, and right, and this is the kind of issue that medieval philosophers dealt with greatly. Whoever wrote this, I think, you know, however that story, the Luz Shebeshedra happened, I think that's the problem they're dealing with.
Yes,
I know.
You
may not find this a convincing approach, but what I'm saying is, literarily, the reason that Luz becomes the city of immortals, right, is because the name Luz has taken a significance, and the right, and the Luz, in addition to Arayom Hazeh, a Luz is already a symbol of immortality.
And that goes way back.
Right,
and that's also in the early Hermetic literature.
But how do you know we didn't name this body part after the city of Luz?
I don't know.
If Luz means immortal, so we just call it the immortal part of the spine.
No, because Luz does mean almond, right? We have other, right? Yaakov takes Luz Varmon.
Okay.
Right. So we know that Luz is in.
But I don't think you can prove which one comes first. Basically.
Can't prove it. I think it makes much more sense to construct the city. I think so. Can never prove historical reconstructions unless you have, you know, signed and dated things, and even then, you know, signed and dated, maybe it's a copy that's signed and dated, you know, you can never, I think the notion of proof is not useful in that category.
Going back to the Shoftim, the judges, we see in the first sentence that in this whole instance of the gift giving, it seems to be a gift that a man is imparting to a man, this gift of immortality, God in it.
It's true, it doesn't say.
It's a pretty big gift to give.
It is true that, you know, that the, that all the, you know, the Jews say we will, you know, we will do chesed with you, and that turns into, you know, God, you know, that turns into, you know, presumably God not letting the angel of death go in, you know, and again, you know, in terms of the ethics of the conquest, you could do a lot with that. Okay.
Sorry.
So where we are, I think, again, all we could take out of this narrative really is just that notion that eternal life is not an unmixed good. But halachically, and this takes us to source number four, which we will at least have a chance to do superficially today. So you'll see that this question becomes problematic in modern times because people have already issuing halachic rulings about assisted suicide, euthanasia, voluntary refusal of care, issues like that. And so Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, Zichrono Livracha, who died earlier this year, who was the Halachic Decisor of Shaarei Tzedek Medical Center in Yerushalayim, and therefore, you know, was generally, also he was one of the judges of the High Rabbinic Court in Jerusalem, but generally, you know, he would be on everyone's list of the top three medical halachists of the past. So he has a, you know, not this is not from a you know, an actual case response, but this is in a dialogue with another rabbi, and apparently that rabbi was aware of a conventional rabbinic position, which said that one could sometimes passively allow death or accept death, but one could never actively cause it for any motive at all. And they were bothered by the city of Luz. It's a city, since in the text we have in the Babylonian Talmud, the elders of Luz walk outside the city. So what, right? So assuming that their action is normative, how can you walk outside a city to death? So everyone begins by saying, well, I think, you know, we only know this second part. He said, I think you answered well, that, you know what, when you walk outside the city, you're not causing your death. You're removing a magical protection. So now this story is being read in a particular halachic context, which distinguishes between there's active, there's passive, and there's something which is not even passive. It's right. There is a double negative. It's the removal of an obstruction. And double negatives, although they are functionally positives, are not legally positives.
They're more passive than passive?
They're more passive than passive. Right,
even though you're doing something.
Yes. The operating metaphor is closing a door to keep the wind from blowing the candle out. Right, you could not straighten the wick to make the candle draw better, but you can close the door to keep the wind from blowing the candle out.
That's more passive than sitting on the couch.
And that is more passive than sitting on the couch and watching the candle. Well, you have to figure out how sitting on the couch and watching.
I didn't blow it out. it's passively doing nothing and having the same result.
Okay, to figure out, you know, you have a passive with consequences as opposed to, I don't know if it's quite that simple.
Is it yeah,
passively killing, no, the example of passively killing somebody is taking them and tying them up in front of a hungry lion. And you leave. Right, so right now, you are not actively causing the death. Right, all you're doing is failing to allow them to go free.
I think it works better.
Might work better if the lion's not actually hungry. Right? Tying them up and leaving them in the desert.
At night.
Right, that's also an example of passive, because you are not the cause. Right? You don't activate the cause of death. You just put them in it. Right, you just fail to save them. Right. Yeah. Even though you create the situation in which you failed to save them.
Yeah.
Right. So
that's, if I actively put them into...
It's still not murder. That's still manslaughter.
It's very dangerous.
It's still manslaughter.
If I'm doing it in order to kill them, it's
still manslaughter. No. Halachically, that is viewed as passive killing.
Well, no, it depends, Robert. If you tie them up in the desert, if you tie them up in the desert at night, that you're not. The murder weapon is not present at the same time.
It's true. That might make a difference as well. Okay, I had fun a couple of years ago trying to design a light switch for Shabbat on this principle, the theory I came up with is you cover the switch, the switch is heat sensitive, you put a heat shield on the switch, you put your hand down next to the switch, now you remove the heat shield. So you're not actually turning on the light, all you're doing is removing the heat shield, which prevented the light from going on. So if we would view that as if we could actually view that as separable actions, and not a single action of putting down your hand and while removing heat shield, that, you know, that might work. So this has resonance, and this is taken based on the Ramah, the standard Ashkenazi code, as the operative principle by most people in halachic medical ethics. Although a lot of contemporary figures, and I first heard this from Rabbi Saul Berman, have pointed out that it's wholly inadequate to deal with reality, and for all the reasons that you intuit, it doesn't work terribly well as a practical guide. The illustration, which either drives one insane or not, for how this making this distinction play out in medical ethics now, is that in Israeli hospitals they had to deal with how they could ever withdraw people from respirators.
Right.
And so the solution they came up with is they put all the respirators on timers.
Uh-huh.
And right, this is a Knesset law. All respirators have to be on timers. Uh-huh. And therefore the respirator will go off unless somebody turns it back on. So when you withdraw care, you don't actually disconnect them. You simply fail to reset the timer. And so that either, you know, so if you have a really...
And if you have a nursing shortage, everyone
Tomb of the Nursing Shortage, everyone dies, yes.
How cheerful.
Or somebody forgets.
So they do this, this is what they actually do.
This apparently is the law in Israel. That's how all respirators are on timers, and that's how they solve. That's how they got the law regarding this through the Knesset. That was the compromise worked out by the.
Now, do you think that's terrible?
So I think that there are this arouses very different. It has very different reactions. People who are really, really in tune with halachic thinking. So this is a perfectly normal thing to do. Mm-hmm. And the point is that you're not interested in the result. You just want something in the process that tells you that what you're doing is right. That this is not something that you can do unreflectively, right? So we tell you, okay, this is not something you can do directly. And you take some people who have no acquaintance with halacha at all, and this is taken as unbelievable Jesuitic casuistry. Either the people should die or they shouldn't, and this doesn't make any sense at all.
Psychologically,
I was in the situation. There's the contemporary biological research, right, that people are hardwired to distinguish between passive and active in that way. Hmm. I've seen some literature.
Talk about, causation. Yeah.
Right, that's what the research is about, right.
It'll say the train will hit him, but the train will stop, and they'll say that you can set
yeah, no, so that's the research that I've seen. I don't know, I think it takes a lot of work to figure out, exactly what, you want to do with a lot of different questions, right, to see if they actually have isolated the factor.
I think they did a whole bunch of different questions.
You have to really, I would want to really check that to see that they have isolated the factor. But I think, it's one of the things I have fun teaching again, where I don't have students who start with halachic instincts, and you have some students who find it intuitively plausible, and some students who just rant. That how can this possibly make a difference? You put the whole darn culture on timers, so now you just understand it can't be right, because then it would just be okay to randomly not reset the timer, right? So there's still a paradox in there. If you're not killing the person, right? If it's really not killing to remove a removal, so then why can't the hospital?
If I really want his money, why can't I just not reset his timer?
Right. So there has to still be something wrong about it. If we're a healthy person, there still has to be something enforceably wrong about it, right? Where you want to, if a nurse decided for fun to fail to turn the timer on for once every 100 patients, right, you want to be able to imprison that nurse. So I don't know that this is actually, even though it appeals to classic halachic categories, I don't know that it's at all satisfying.
There's the moral and the legal.
But I think it has to be legally bound in this case. I really do. I think it has to be legally. I think it has to be actionable to fail to turn on somebody's respirator. Certainly, in a hospital setting, we have a duty. Okay, so we'll pick up how Tzitzit Eliezer reads this next time and see. Right, and talk about whether that's reasonable, and then we will move on to a couple of other narratives. There are three other narratives that are usually cited in this context: the death of Rabbi Judah the Prince, the death of Rechaniah ben Tradion, and a particular elderly woman, all of them mentioned. And hopefully we'll see you all in 2 weeks.